Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren formally explores running for president.
Our government's supposed to work for all of us, but instead, it has become a tool for the wealthy and well-connected.
Also today, a look back at 1968 and the political debate still raging in America 50 years later. The assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which set off violent riots across the country.
So let us look at each other and pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace.
And how the assassination of RFK led to a brutal clash in Chicago and a schism in the Democratic Party.
What's your name, sir?
And what is your name, sir? Take your hands off of me.
Dan Rather.
Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please.
It's all next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is a special edition of Radio Boston. Let's go live now to Senator Elizabeth Warren, speaking from her home in Cambridge.
And today I announced an exploratory committee for President of the United States. I never thought I would run for anything ever in my life, but America's middle class is getting hollowed out, and opportunity for too many of our young people is shrinking. So I'm in this fight all the way. Right now, Washington works great for the wealthy and the well-connected. It's just not working for anyone else. But I am optimistic. I believe in what we can do together. I'm going to build a grassroots campaign. It's already got people from all across this country who are going to be part of it, and together we're going to make change. And if people out there see it and want to be part of it, I hope they go to ElizabethWarren.com and join us, because this is how we're going to build the movement that will change America. So thank you all for being here. You have a question?
You know the urgency that a lot of Democrats feel about defeating Donald Trump in 2020. What's your message to the Democratic primary voter who says, I love where Senator Warren stands on the issues, but I worry about electability. I worry about a campaign more about Native American ancestry than the middle class.
You know, look, I'm in this fight because I understand what's happening to working families. I grew up in a paycheck-to-paycheck family, and my big chance was a commuter college that cost $50 a semester. I run for office because I'm grateful down to my toes for the opportunities that were given to me, and I am determined that we will give those same opportunities, not just to some of our kids, but to all of our kids. I think when we fight for something positive, for something big, when we show, not just tell, but show what Democrats will get out there and make happen, I think that's how we win.
Senator Theo.
Sure. You know, look, the way I see it right now, Washington works great for giant drug companies, but just not for people who are trying to get a prescription filled. Washington works great for for-profit colleges and student loan outfits, but not for young people who are getting crushed by student loan debt. And you could keep going through the list. The problem we've got right now in Washington is that it works great for those who've got money to buy influence. And I'm fighting against that, and you bet it's going to make a lot of people unhappy. But at the end of the day, I don't go to Washington to work for them. Our government should be working for the people, and that's the movement I'm going to lead.
Senator, you articulated this very point throughout the course of your career, and you saw a real estate developer from New York expropriate that message in 2016. How do you basically convince people that this message is still a message that belongs to the Democratic Party, given that it's, again, it's been expropriated and used effectively by a real estate developer?
We have to get out there and be clear about what we're fighting for, and then we got to show we're willing to fight for it. It's not enough just to talk the talk. We've actually got to be willing to get out and walk the walk. And that means we've got to stand behind the kinds of changes that will matter in the lives of everyday people. And when that means standing up to big drug companies, we won't do what this administration has done, and that is said, raise prices whenever you want. We'll say we're going to make real change.
Follow up. How does your message compare to that of Sherrod Brown, for example, and others who are making some of the same points?
You know, I think it's great that we have a strong and growing group of Democrats who are making these arguments, who are fighting these fights. That's how we build a movement. We do it together.
Senator Warren, you have not been afraid to take on Donald Trump really head-to-head in the past. Do you expect that you will need to go head-to-head, toe-to-toe with him and hurl it right back at him, as you know he has already started to do with you? Is that part of winning this?
Look, I think the central part of winning this is to get out and talk with people about what we're fighting for. We want a government that works not just for the rich and the powerful. We want a government that works for everyone. And we can make that happen. We have to do it together. I think that's how we win.
Senator Warren, now that you have had a few weeks to think about this, if you were to do it over again today, would you handle the release of the DNA test any differently today?
You know, look, I've put it all out there. It's there for anyone to see. But at the end of the day, what this is going to be about, this election going forward, is going to be about the tens of millions of families across this country who work hard, who play by the rules, and who just time after time take one body blow after another. It has been decades in which profits have gone through the roof and workers' incomes have stayed flat, in which the costs of housing have gone up, the costs of health care have gone up, the costs of an education have gone up, and yet families aren't getting more money to cover all of that. I think that's going to be the central issue in this campaign. Who do you think government should work for? Republicans, Donald Trump, have made clear they think government should work for the wealthy and the well-connected. And right now, that's exactly what it's doing. I think it ought to work for everyone else, and that's what this fight is about.
Does Super PACs have a place in this race?
I'm sorry?
Do Super PACs have a place in this race? Would you take support from Super PACs?
So, look, I believe that as Democrats, the way we're going to win in 2020 is by building a grassroots movement all across this country. And that means we have to build this movement with small-dollar donors, with volunteers, with real people. I don't think we ought to be running campaigns that are funded by billionaires, whether it goes through super PACs or their own money that they're spending. Democrats are the party of the people. And the way we make that clear is we join together and we fund our campaigns. We make our campaigns work through the people. By the way, today already, since I've made the announcement this morning, I've already received donations from all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. That's how you build a grassroots campaign. That's what I believe in.
Massachusetts voters, you just won re-election.
Yep.
Your message to voters who say now she's more focused on running for president rather than representing Massachusetts.
You know,
what's your take on that?
I'm in the fight for all of our families. It's the same fight that drew me in to elected politics to begin with. I want to see an America that works, not just for some people, but an America that works for all of us. That's why
Are
I'm
you and
in
your
this.
Family ready
so,
for this?
Well, you can actually, I have to say, Bailey is really behaving himself here. He looks ready for it. You know, I'm about to go off and make phone calls to some supporters all around the country. Tonight, Bruce and I are going to do what we do every New Year's Eve. We're going to watch Casablanca. cheer at all the cheering parts and cry at all the sad parts, and have a good evening. And I will see all of you, I hope, again very soon. Happy New Year to all of you. Take
Bruce,
care.
Thank you.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking outside of her home in Cambridge. I'm Jamie Bologna, and you're listening to Radio Boston. We, of course, are hearing from Warren because she said today that she'll be forming an exploratory committee, which will allow her to raise money and fill staff positions in preparation for a likely 2020 run for the presidency. And donations, she claims, came in from all 50 states thus far. She just made her progressive case for the presidency, wanting a government that works for everyone. And to get into more of the nuts and bolts of this possible Elizabeth Warren run for the presidency, I want to turn now to WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, are you there?
Hey, Jamie. Good to be with you.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well.
Also with us on the line is Kimberly Atkins from Washington. She's the chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there. Hi there. How are you?
Good, good. So first, I just want to get both of your reactions real quick to what you heard Elizabeth Warren say there outside of her home in Cambridge. Anthony.
Yeah. Well, Jamie, I mean, her message has been remarkably consistent for a long time, and she's already done a lot to prepare for a presidential run. She's raised lots of money. She's campaigned across the country for fellow Democrats. She's been raising her national profile. And so in many ways, this announcement this morning wasn't really surprising to any of us who have been watching this. We've been expecting this. And really what you heard was an appeal for a progressive view of government in this country. And this is sort of the pitch that Warren has been making for a long, long time. And she wants to carry it all the way to the White House. And there's a lot of reasons to believe that this is a pitch that can appeal to a lot of people across the country. And there's also a lot of reasons to believe that there are a lot of obstacles between here and the White House for Elizabeth Warren. But consider this day one. Consider this, she's off to the races, as they say, and she's sort of the first in among the major potential candidates, and that's for good reason because, filing for an exploratory committee means that you're essentially setting up the means to raise a lot of money to attract staff, and so she's first in a sense, and for good reason.
Yeah, and I mean, at the same time, Kimberly, you know, in what we just heard from her, she didn't go directly after Trump. She dodged the question on the DNA testing. What do you make of the timing of all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the timing, it's exactly right. It's meant to get out early in what will be a very crowded field, try to lock down that apparatus, which includes staffing, sort of try to claim that front runner status and possibly some people who may not have the fundraising prowess that she has may think twice as they ponder whether they too will jump in the race. I think in January, you're going to see a bit of a free-for-all. A lot of people will announce either exploratory committees or outright candidacies. I think we'll start seeing that in the upcoming weeks. So she was trying to get out ahead, but in terms of dodging all the questions that was asked, I was listening as she kept saying, you know, we're going to build this movement.
She stayed on message. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're Washington only works for the rich and powerful, and we need to change that. And we're building a movement. That was the answer to every question, whether the question was about Trump or whether her DNA test or anything else. And so we're seeing her today stay very much on message. And that is something that she's going to try to do throughout her campaign. As folks here in Washington know, she, for most of her time here, didn't talk to the press, in part
right.
because she always wanted to stay on message and didn't want to be stopped by folks like us in the hallways who may try to veer her off of that. But we'll see a lot more of that carefully answering of questions as she moves forward.
And Anthony, since she was asked about the DNA test and her heritage there outside her home in Cambridge, I do want to ask you about something that Chris Saliza, a political commentator at CNN, wrote today. He said that, you know, her attempt earlier this year to put questions about her heritage to rest was botched and a disaster. He went on to say that it, quote, raised doubts even in the minds of her most loyal supporters about her capacity to run and win in 2020. Is that a fair analysis? And do you think this question will keep dogging her?
Well, I think the question probably will keep dogging her. I guess if you're Elizabeth Warren, the one positive thing you could say about that is better sort of to get it out of the way early, because you'd think that sooner or later this is going to run out of gas. But yeah, I mean, she definitely made an effort to kind of respond first and foremost to Donald Trump's endless prodding of her, calling her Pocahontas. Mm-hmm. And it did seem like a sort of naive idea that you could sort of confront the president with facts. So she does this DNA test. The DNA test provides pretty compelling evidence that she has Indian American, Native American ancestry. But Donald Trump has never been one to be bothered by facts. So in a way, this played right into his wheelhouse. And he just made fun of the low percentage of the Indian ancestry in her bloodline. And then there's the whole sort of controversy about using DNA technology to prove sort of racial identity. I mean, that's a sort of controversial thing in itself. Mm-hmm. So on two levels, it seemed like a kind of botched effort on her part. You know, but I think what she's hoping she can do, and Kimberly was talking about it just a moment ago, is that if you stay on message and you keep talking about the way the middle class is being hollowed out, the way working Americans are essentially being assaulted by a corrupt federal government, that message will take hold and carry the day. And, you know, it's worth noting that Donald Trump talked about draining the swamp. I mean, that was one of his central themes when he ran for president. And it worked for him in large part. Now, obviously, you can debate whether he has drained the swamp or not, but that he keyed into that idea for a good reason, because people care about that.
Well, and I think this is the kind of message, too, that we were hearing from Bernie Sanders in 2016, a middle class hollowed out, a Washington that doesn't work for everyone, a grassroots movement. And to that point, WBUR spoke with Jeffrey Berry. He's a political science professor at Tufts University. And he told us that this early announcement is a move aimed specifically at Sanders.
She's very intent on pushing him out of the race as quickly as possible and getting Sanders' 2016 supporters on her side and building up a coalition.
Kimberly, what do you make of that analysis there?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that of all the potential buzzed about Democratic candidates so far, Bernie Sanders is clearly the one who most overlaps Elizabeth Warren's lane in terms of their message of progressivism. They've sort of been two sides of the same coin for a really long time. But I don't think that he's the only one that she's trying to push. I think she's trying to push other folks who may not have the money or the name recognition who are really pondering if this is something that they want to go through. And she also wants to be a part of the conversation when it comes to other people who she's likely not going to push out. But she wants to be a part of the discussions as they begin to announce their plans. Folks like Senator Kamala Harris, mm-hmm. Senator Cory Booker, Congressman Beto O'Rourke. She wants to get her name out there first. And get some fundraising under her belt before the race really starts to get crowded.
So, Anthony, you covered the 2018 midterms, as you did, Kimberly. And Warren is fresh off a second-term win in the Senate. She captured 61% of the vote, while Jeff Deal, her challenger, took 36%. But, you know, Massachusetts is considered pretty safe ground for Democrats. And Charlie Baker, a Republican, got more votes than she did here in Massachusetts. He got 67%. Do you think that's a warning sign for Warren going forward nationally?
I mean, I think it's incredibly awkward or sort of, you know, we got to be cautious about talking about polls two
sure.
years before an election. But, you know, I think you raise a good point, Jamie. I mean, one of the sort of rules of the game, I guess, is, she managed to win re-election fairly easily in blue state Massachusetts, but Charlie Baker won more Democratic votes than she did. And, you know, the polling that we've done, Elizabeth Warren is popular enough, certainly popular enough to win, but she has fairly high negatives as well. And so obviously that would be a concern. I mean, look, any candidate is going to have a set of concerns going into just about any race. That would certainly be among the concerns that Elizabeth Warren would have. Why, if she has such high negatives in Massachusetts, imagine what they might be in a state that's a little more red.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I think that sort of speaks to the biggest challenge, and that is there are lots of prominent Massachusetts politicians, and you can go down the list from Mitt Romney to Michael Dukakis to John Kerry to going back to Paul Tsongas, all kinds of people.
Ted Kennedy. Kimberly, you tweeted this out earlier today, yeah.
Ted Kennedy, obviously, yeah. So, you know, it becomes increasingly difficult to make this case across the country that a very liberal someone who's associated with an organization like Harvard University is somehow the right person to carry the mantle for Democrats in a general election.
Well, Anthony,
it can happen, but it's a challenge that she's going to have to deal with.
And to that point, the Republican National Committee issued a statement today. RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel said Senator Warren couldn't be more out of touch, and with her lack of support from voters, including in her home state, on top of her phony claim to minority status, now that she's formally running, America will see her for what she is, another extreme far-left obstructionist and a total fraud. That's one view. Stick with me here, Kimberly and Anthony, real quick, because I want to bring in Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer Ed Lyons for his take. Hi, Ed.
Hey, Jamie. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us here. So I just read that statement there from the RNC, but what's your take on all of this today?
Well, I'm glad that everybody's finally admitting that our senator is actually running. She has been for months. I mean, she was ready to take donations from Puerto Rico all right away, but, you know, she's very good at her job. I'm a little concerned. I like what I heard earlier. I do think that, you know, what sells in Massachusetts might not sell elsewhere. I think that she will be easily portrayed as sort of the liberal elite, you know, a well-paid law professor who is from a very blue state. I'm not sure that's the best person to carry the flag going forward with the Democrats. It's not up to me, but I agree with those objections. Also, as a Massachusetts resident, I'm a little concerned about sort of her kind of weighing kind of what's good for her presidential campaign versus what's good for us in Massachusetts. Perhaps her maximum attack on Donald Trump all the time might not be in our interest in the crisis to come when Robert Mueller reports.
Right, right. Well, but so, Ed, I do want to ask you about this idea that, you know, we heard Trump voters say that they would have gone, or some Trump voters say they would have gone for Bernie Sanders if he had been a choice. And I'm just curious if you think any of those or many of those voters would vote for Elizabeth Warren.
Sure. I think that I think we kind of oversimplify the electorate. I think there are plenty of people that would have voted for Trump or Sanders. I'm not so sure those people would vote for Senator Warren. I think that she's a little bit different than him. I think.
And why is that?
More kind of low to the ground. I'm not confident that that Warren can just pick up all those voters the way that he did, even though Warren has spoken compellingly about the middle class in the past.
So, but why do you believe that?
I just think Senator Sanders' campaign just felt a little bit different. It was sort of he was never sort of this national superstar before he ran for the presidency. I think that he spoke very convincingly about the little guy getting screwed. I know that Senator Warren does that too, but I just always found Senator Sanders to be a bit more authentic, and I think authenticity is really important for voters.
Well, that's Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer Ed Lyons. Ed, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Anthony, pick up that point there from Ed about the authenticity factor, because this isn't the first time we've heard this about a female candidate for president.
Yeah, I think it's such an important point. And you know, I'm not in a position to sort of assess whether or not Elizabeth Warren is going to come across and convince people that she's authentic. But clearly that is the challenge. I mean, I went to a lot of Donald Trump rallies leading up to 2016, talked to a lot of his supporters, and it almost didn't matter what he said. When I would try to engage people about policy, it almost was beside the point. What people cared about was, this is a real guy who speaks my language.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds trite, and I know that sounds sort of hollow 2 years into his presidency, but it's the way a lot of people make their decisions. And if Elizabeth Warren can convince a lot of people that she's the real deal, that she's lived their experience, that she can really relate to them, then she could go far. But as Ed Lyons was suggesting, you know, if people are going to relate to her as part of an elite academic institution, part of the Northeastern coastal elite, then it's not going to be a good outcome for her.
Kimberly but Atkins, yes. We've got just about 10 seconds left here. Just your final thoughts here as we go out.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I also think it's important to remember that Massachusetts voters really hate when their candidates run for national office, so I would be careful to use a Massachusetts poll to judge anything. Remember, Mitt Romney didn't run for re-election because he couldn't, because he was already running for president.
Well, a lot to look forward to in 2019. That's Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald. Thank you so much, Kimberly.
Thank you.
And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jamie.
Happy New Year to both of you. Stay with us. We'll be back after the break. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. And listeners, I just want to be upfront here and say that we'd planned this hour to be a special on-tape edition of Radio Boston, but we're live today. Because of that announcement right at the top from Elizabeth Warren that she's exploring a run for the White House. We had planned to revisit conversations from the past year that look at how so many of the events and emotions of 2018 can be traced back to another tumultuous year in our nation's history, 1968. And the whole team here at Radio Boston, but in particular Chris Siderick, worked really hard to craft today's themed show. So now we want to bring you much of that show because, as we heard at the top from Warren, so many of the things that resonated in 1968 are still here today. And the truth is, in 1968, 50 years ago, the country dealt with similar fissures. A little later in the hour, we'll hear about how the assassination of civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. in April 1968 sparked riots across the country, further escalating racial tensions as the civil rights movement was gaining steam. But first, since we're on this topic of politics, we want to revisit June 5th, 1968, when presidential hopeful Senator Robert F. Kennedy took the stage at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, having just won the California primary. It would be a fateful night that would change the course of American political history.
The divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a selfish country and a compassionate country. And I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of the next year.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've kept the air on because we've heard an alarming report that Robert Kennedy was shot in that ballroom at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles.
A doctor, we need a doctor right here. The microphone, please, immediately.
A very loud noise like a clap of thunder was heard, a small explosion. We waited to see what it was, and then came a report that Senator Robert Kennedy was shot.
Is there a doctor? Everybody, please stay back. Please stay back. We need a doctor here.
So far, that's all the information we have.
Kennedy died one day later on June 6th, 1968. His death splintered the Democratic Party and created a schism that culminated in days of rage and chaos at the party's convention in August, Chicago, just 2 months after his death. With the Vietnam War at its apex, anti-war protesters and activists clashed with police outside the convention. Inside, delegates and party members argued loudly, the political machine squaring off against those who felt left behind by the status quo. Former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis was at the convention in Chicago in 1968, and he spoke with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick earlier this year about what it was like to be at the center of it all and how the events of that weekend fundamentally transformed our country's politics in ways still being felt today.
Needless to say, it was a very, very tough and very tense time for a lot of reasons. First, President Kennedy's assassination, troubles over the Vietnam War and what was going on at the time, the Civil Rights Revolution, and it was all happening simultaneously. And the convention itself was a boiling cauldron.
Yeah, ultimately, 650 people were arrested, 100 protesters, 49 police officers treated for injuries. Did you see any of the commotion outside at all, or were you inside
the
hall?
Well, most of us who were delegates didn't see it because we were basically in the convention all day long for several days.
Right.
We were certainly hearing about it and watching it on our television sets at night. And for reasons I'm not sure I understood, the demonstrators or somebody decided to go at some of the hotels, and I remember the distinct odor of what I guess were mothballs that had been set on fire and gave off a terrible odor. But inside the convention hall wasn't fun either. As a matter of fact, one of the evenings, one of the important evenings, I found a Chicago sanitation man sitting in my seat who looked as if he had just come off the truck. And apparently these were folks that Mayor Daley kind of invited to occupy the convention hall. So I said to him, I said, sorry, but I'm Mike Dukakis. I'm a state rep from Massachusetts, and I think you're in my seat. And he was nice enough about leaving, but it gives you some sense of what was going on even inside the place. And then, of course, we had the mayor himself, when Governor Ribicoff was speaking, going after him with a vicious anti-Semitic remark. It wasn't fun inside. Obviously, it was much tougher and worse outside.
Yeah, you're talking about Connecticut Governor Ribicoff.
Yeah, right.
So you talked about it a little bit in the first answer, but if you can kind of bring us back to 1968, the country's in the middle of the civil rights movement, dealing with the Vietnam War. What was it like?
In a very divided Democratic Party, needs to say, we had an incumbent president who was a terrific domestic president, but got ourselves and got us involved in this Vietnam War, which was not going well and dividing the country in a very profound way. I mean, young people in particular opposed to it, older folks to some extent staying with it. There was enormous anger and enormous resentment. And when you put the civil rights movement into that and profound changes going on, especially in the South, but all over the country, the passage of three major civil rights laws over a period of 4 or 5 years, and then to top it off, first the assassination of a president in 63, then the split within the Democratic Party, Bobby Kennedy's candidacy along with Gene McCarthy's, and then the assassination of Kennedy and Martin Luther King within a relatively short period of time. I mean, it was a very, very difficult time.
Can you talk a little bit about, specifically here in Boston, what was the political, social fabric like here?
Well, we were facing exactly the same pressures and tensions and anger elsewhere. Remember, we had our own problems here. I grew up in the town of Brookline, where until the late 60s or early 70s, a person of color couldn't live in the town of Brookline. We had literally three African-American families lived in the town. Two were janitors who lived in basements with their families. And then a renowned tenor who somehow found somebody who was willing to sell him a house, what we call Pill Hill. That was it. If you were a person of color, you just didn't live in towns like Brookline.
So you have this kind of flashpoint event at the convention in 1968. How did that change the Democratic Party from there on?
Well, the Democratic Party, like all parties, I suppose, evolved and evolves. Remember, it was Franklin Roosevelt who was the great change agent when it came to the Democratic Party and turned it into a strong progressive force. It hadn't been that up until that time. It was badly divided. We had a lot of Southerners in the Congress who called themselves Democrats who were racist, very conservative. And so that whole upheaval was taking place at the same time. But parties evolve. Of course, at that time, you had conservatives and Democrats in both parties. And there were political scientists at the time, I remember, who I studied in college saying, this is ridiculous. The parties ought to stand for something. Parties ought to have a distinct philosophy so people know what they're voting for. Well, the critics got their wish, right? And now we have two parties which are really about as divided ideologically as I can recall in my lifetime.
That's former Massachusetts governor and presidential hopeful Michael Dukakis speaking about his experience at the Democratic National Convention in August 1968. He spoke with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Stay with us after a quick break as we continue our look back at 1968, 50 years later. This is Radio Boston, and I'm Jamie Bologna. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. We want to continue now our reflection on 1968, 50 years ago. In the last segment, we heard about the turmoil at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and we're reminded that it was a year of bitter political battles, simmering racial tension, a country grappling with its values and its sense of identity. So much of what happened then feels eerily familiar today, and much of what happened this past year have roots that trace back to 68.
But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the star.
We have affirmed that while this could go down as the darkest time in our history, we won't let it be.
We're getting some terrible decisions from the Ninth Circuit, as usual.
Some of our courts, in their decisions, have gone too far in weakening the peace forces as against the criminal forces in this country.
The fact is, people respect law and order.
So I pledge to you, we shall have order in the United States.
One of those moments from 1968 that is still reverberating is the assassination of Martin Luther King. Some would say that his speech at the March on Washington in August of 1963 changed the course of this nation's history.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Less than 5 years later, in April 1968, he was shot and killed in Memphis, Tennessee. WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty marked the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death with a special hour here at Radio Boston, beginning with a look back at the fateful events in Memphis and how they were felt here in Boston.
April 4th, 1968, Memphis, Tennessee. Just one day after Dr. Martin Luther King gave what would be his final speech.
Trouble is in the land, confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the star.
NBC interrupts its regular program schedule to bring you the following special report.
Dr. Martin Luther King has been shot and wounded, possibly critically wounded, in Memphis, Tennessee this evening.
We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place.
Dr. King left his room, 306, at the Lorraine Hotel just before dinner to get some air. Police say 205 feet away, in a window in a flophouse, the assassin waited.
But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will.
Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street.
I said, Dr. King. That was it. I said, Dr. King, just as he straightened up. I said, Dr. King, and the bullet exploded in his face.
And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men.
So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
On April 5th, President Lyndon Johnson addressed the nation.
Once again, the heart of America is heavy. The spirit of America weeps for a tragedy that denies the very meaning of our land.
And in Boston, Mayor Kevin White pleaded for peace.
24 hours ago, Dr. King died for all of us, black and white. That we may live together in harmony without violence and in peace. This is our city, and its future is in our hands. Tonight, and tomorrow, and the days that follow.
We didn't want Boston to go up in the same kind of flames that other cities were facing.
Sarah Ann Shaw was WBZ's first ever black female television reporter. She covered the city for more than 30 years.
That day, people were calling each other and said, have you heard? Have you heard? Is it true? Is it true? No, I think people were just so stunned. We heard it, but I'm sure that I didn't really believe that it had happened.
Shaw recalls how on the night of April 5th, James Brown was scheduled to play the Boston Garden. He did.
It's getting late in the evening. I can't get right. I guess I did the boogaloo. The funky Broadway. Good God.
Boston Mayor Kevin White had urged Brown not only to go on with the show, but also to televise it live on WGBH. He did that, too. And that night, the Godfather of Soul introduced Boston's mayor to the stage.
Mayor Kevin White, give him a big round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. He's a swinging cat.
Mayor White urged peace.
Martin Luther King loved this city, and it's up to our generation to prove his faith in us. So all I ask you tonight is this. So let us look at each other. Here in the gardens and back at home, and pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace.
Boston answered the call. Sarah Ann Shaw says,
and it worked.
But that's right!
James Brown in Boston on April 5th, 1968. Well, joining me now is Jason Sokol. He's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of the new book, The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Walter Fluker. He's the Martin Luther King Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Boston University School of Theology. He's also editor of the Howard Thurman Papers Project and the director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Initiative for the Development of Ethical Leadership. Walter Fluker, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
So you heard Mayor White mentioning King's love of Boston and Boston's love of Dr. King. What do you think it was about that relationship between the man and the city that perhaps allowed less unrest here on April 5th than we saw in other American cities?
I can't speak directly to how King's love of the city would have impacted that, but I do think that the size of the Boston population of African Americans had probably much to do with that. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I can assure you it was quite different that evening there. But the size, but I do think that with James Brown being present, it provided a kind of palliative for the crowds that were there. And certainly Kevin White, whom I understand really didn't know who James Brown was able to use that very effectively and should be applauded.
So, I mean, you were in Chicago in 1968 on the day and the aftermath of King's assassination. I mean, give us a comparison. What was it like in Chicago?
Well, we in Chicago, there were riots, especially on the west side. I was on the south side of Chicago. And many of those neighborhoods, even now, are still struggling to come back. There was burning, there was looting, and a lot of violence. And I was sharing with my colleague here that I remember that evening my father, who was a very peaceful man, this sorrow and the rage that were intermixed. And I think his feelings were emblematic of what was happening throughout the city among African Americans in particular.
Yeah. Jason Sokol, I mean, reflect with me on that. What do you hear in Walter Fluker's experience?
Well, I think so many African Americans alternated between grief and rage, and that was African Americans across the country. I read essays from high school students in Memphis to older generations of African Americans across northern cities, and they, even African Americans who disagreed with King about violence and nonviolence, still felt this profound loss.
Right.
Even as others were moved to more violent action.
Well, in your book, you contrast that to the reactions of white Americans. I mean, because we have the tendency now to play the tape from, which we've done this hour and we probably will do more, play the tape from President Johnson. We have the tendency to play Robert Kennedy's famous speech in Indianapolis. But the truth of white America's reaction in 1968 was far more varied than that.
Some white Americans rejoiced at King's assassination. They thought King was a rabble-rouser, an agitator, a troublemaker, and this was because of his Poor People's Campaign, his opposition to the Vietnam War. And they basically thought he had it coming. There are other whites, there are, you know, a segment of liberal whites who joined with African Americans in grief and loss. And then there was a large majority of white people who just weren't all that impressed by King's assassination one way or another. You know, these are people who had grieved at President Kennedy's assassination and would grieve at Robert Kennedy's, but they felt that many whites felt that the wound of King's death was a wound felt by black people and not by them.
Interesting. I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from an ABC News report on the night of Dr. King's death, speaking with children on the streets of Harlem.
Well, it's a feeling of partly sadness and mostly hatred because, they didn't really want him to die like he died. They want, you know, to die, you know. They didn't want him to die like he died.
You say hatred.
Yeah.
What is the hatred aimed at?
At mostly the white people.
Why?
Because it was a white man that shot Martin Luther King.
Walter Fluker, how do you react to that?
I think he was speaking his truth.
Yeah.
And it certainly was not unusual for people to feel that way. I mentioned my father's rage, but I had even there were repercussions beyond his assassination. I remember the next month we were playing another high school football, and I was part of one of the biggest riots I'd ever witnessed and still have witnessed anywhere. After the game, all of the black students just began to jump on the white students in the middle of the street. And it was a direct result, I think, of the King assassination and the deep, harrowing uncertainty about the future.
Yeah.
And rage.
Well, so contrast that then with what you write in your book, Jason Sokol, about how deeply the hatred or sort of white America, some of white America's hatred of Dr. King is evidence in the way some children responded to King's death. I'm seeing here that you write, among white students in Florida's public schools, for instance, 41% thought the assassination was King's own fault. 17% believe the killer ought to receive congratulations.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes to show that it wasn't just an older generation of white Southerners who had this hatred for King. The children absorbed that hatred, and then they parroted the criticisms they had heard from their parents and their leaders.
So I want to play something else here, Walter Fluker, because you are the editor of the Howard Thurman papers. We have some tape here of Howard Thurman himself, who was the dean of BU's Marsh Chapel, served as Dr. King's mentor as well. Is that fair to say?
He was a mentor,
yeah.
Yes.
Now, he delivered a statement following Dr. King's assassination. He gave the statement at the church that he had co-founded with Dr. King in San Francisco.
There are no words with which to eulogize this man. Martin Luther King was the living epitome of a way of life that rejected physical violence as the lifestyle of a morally responsible people. His assassination reveals the cleft deep in the psyche of the American people.
When we hear Howard Thurman in the immediate aftermath of King's assassination talking about his that the assassination reveals the cleft deep in the psyche of the American people, I keep coming back to the fact that we're here in 2018. But in 1968, in the immediate aftermath, did King's death set back that goal of racial justice through nonviolent means?
I think it revealed what was already there. I think it was a revelation. It was the very same claim that W.E.B. Du Bois and others had said, that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. And I think in many ways, what was revealed then has even been further exacerbated by some current political and other events.
Yeah. Jason Sokol, what's your thought on that? I mean, this is basically the heart of your book, right?
Yeah, it is. I think part of what Walter means was it was revealing what was already there, is there was this schism within the black freedom struggle over, are you going to try nonviolence, or are you going to be more militant? And King was one of the last people who was trying to talk to both sides. I mean, he was one of the last figures who had legitimacy with both camps. And once he was gone, I think the hopes of bringing the movement together, the hopes also of bringing whites and blacks together, were set back greatly, and then revealed this persistent white hatred, which has also, I think, endured up until our time.
Set back greatly, but for how long? I mean, all the way to today?
I think that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
There was a division, of course, among African-American leadership regarding the pros and cons of nonviolent resistance. But what I was saying is that this deep cleft, this chasm that Thurman is alluding to, was indeed the problem of racism in our society. And, of course, we've seen it in many ways expand, maybe even deepen in some other kind of ways.
Mm.
Charlottesville would be one example of that.
Walter Fluker is the Martin Luther King Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Boston University School of Theology and editor of the Howard Thurman Papers and director of the MLK Initiative for Development of Ethical Leadership. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Jason Sokol, Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. It was a real pleasure to have you. And next time I'm going to invite you back so we can talk about the global response to Dr. King's death.
I would love to. Thank you.
As well. But since we are talking about Dr. King's legacy 50 years after his assassination, I actually wanted to end this show today with the words of Coretta Scott King. Because just 2 days after Dr. King was assassinated, she spoke at a press conference at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. And for as immortal as Dr. King's words are, these words from Coretta Scott King live on powerfully today as well, because she talked about the work that's yet to be done.
So once again, I have put aside traditional family considerations because my husband's work for his people and for all poor people transcends our wish for privacy. The day that the Negro people and others in bondage are truly free, on the day want is abolished, on the day wars are no more, on that day I know my husband will rest in a long-deserved peace.
Coretta Scott King speaking about what remains to be done before her husband, Martin Luther King Jr., can rest in peace. That'll do it for 2018 here at Radio Boston. Our show is produced by Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. From the entire Radio Boston team, we want to wish you all out there a safe and happy new year. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna.